exciting.
Welcome back to another episode of PDGA Radio. Grant Zellner and Jennifer Allen on this second to last. No, would it be the third to last? I don't know what day it is. All I know is March is almost done. We're a quarter of the way through 2022, and I can't believe it. Jennifer, how was your weekend? You played out in California, is that correct?
I did. My home away from home out in San Diego. Another one of my favorite courses out there, Kit Carson. They put on, Mark and his entire crew put on an incredible tournament. This is a tournament that has been postponed for multiple years due to COVID. The restrictions there in that area have been very tight. And so we were all very excited to get back and finally have this memorial event.
Oh, well, good for them. Another tournament happened this weekend as well. You decided to omit the Texas Swing from your schedule. You're going to be back at the Champions Cup later this month. But, you know, Texas States was this past weekend, and we would be remiss to not recap a little bit of that exciting weekend of disc golf. First of all, Paige Pierce holding down home state advantage at Texas States, 17 down, won it on the last hole. That was fantastic.
That's such a fun course. I know they've redesigned it since I've played it. That was actually, I love have a little special place in my heart for that course because that's where I got my 100th win. So I've been down there and played that course. If you can hit your lines, the distance is a great advantage. And I think Paige capitalized on that this weekend.
Really, really tight all the way down to that last hole where Paige landed inbounds and her two nearest competitors at that moment, Kristen and Katrina, both managed to find OB on that hole. And then we're sort of forced to go for broke. And when that didn't work out, Paige's birdie on the last gave her a 4-stroke victory. Jennifer, I was looking at the stats at PGA's live scoring. And an interesting thing I thought about the course was just the way it played sort of true to par for the FPO field. I thought that was really, really interesting. It was great seeing the FPO field get to have eagle opportunities on several holes. That was really, really exciting and really fun to see the kinds of swings that would happen when, say, one player eagled and another just parred. You know, normally you're not losing 2 strokes with a par, but that kind of thing was happening during the course of the week. It made for a super exciting weekend of disc golf. I wish I could have been there in person to have seen it, as I'm sure so many others do.
That's why I love par 4s and 5 courses is for that reason. It's not because I throw far. It's exactly for the excitement that, you know, you just mentioned. So having those long, challenging holes really brings some excitement sometimes.
Those score swings are so exciting. We saw so many of those in the MPO field as well. Ricky Wysocki, 6 for 6. At Texas State. He's played it 6 times. They haven't been consecutive. If you're not aware, Texas State's normally skips a year. But 6 for 6 at Texas State, that's on multiple different tracks. Even the track this year there in Tyler was a different 18 than was played last time they played in Tyler. He comes out with a 1-stroke victory over Calvin Heimberg. Greg Barsby right there in the mix right up until the very last. Gets himself a podium finish there at the Thorn Long Course there in Tyler, Texas. A super exciting weekend for the men. Did you get a chance to see any of that at all or follow it?
No.
You were after playing.
After golf, I would go to the beach. That's my happy place. I go and I reset. Unfortunately, my son did not walk away quite so well from us goofing off at the beach after my round. His, like, last run, throw, catch, he, I think, broke his toe, but that's okay.
Oh, no. Well, you had other things. Well, when you go back and you watch a little bit of this coverage, as I know you often like to do, you're going to see some interesting things there in the MPO field as well. I thought something, I'm going to go back and watch looking for this specifically. I'm again, scrolling through on PDGA.com's live stats here for the event. A number of the par threes played under par. A number of the par fours played over par.
Wow.
Which is almost backwards from what you would expect. The course really challenged the players to take advantage when they could and then to play smartly on some of these really, really challenging holes that this new Thorn layout provided for them. And I was shocked when I went and looked this up. Yeah, here, par three, hole number five, played to a 2.8 stroke average. So 0.2 of a stroke under par. And, you know, here, hole number four, played more than a half stroke over par, and it was a par four already. So, and that, that just continues throughout the 18, that sort of pattern. It's really exciting, I think, to watch professionals both in the NPO field and the MPO field challenge to that degree relentlessly throughout the course of 18 holes. It made for an exciting weekend of disc golf.
Yeah, that's just one bad kick that gets you so far in there that it's hard to scramble and save those pars on that type of a course. And I think it's interesting, too, you brought up Ricky 6 for 6. You either love or hate Texas. Being from Oklahoma, we you know, Oklahomans have a love-hate Texas relationship for more than one reason. But you see those players who either never miss Texas, like Ricky does, always plays well down there. Or the opposite, people who like, I'm not going to Texas. The weather's crazy. It's always windy.
Yep.
You know, so Texas is definitely known for that love-hate relationship.
Yeah, you definitely get used to the conditions in this part of the country. And I'm learning personally now that I'm traveling more as part of the PDGA, I'm learning about the particulars of the conditions in a lot of other parts of the country, and they are so unique. And it's no surprise that you see players really excel in one, not just on different types of courses, but in one region. You see players really excel in one region, mountain courses, for example, or you know, really green sort of northern courses that are so lush and so full, and, you know, discs don't skip as much and things like that. They really excel in different parts of the country. So it's exciting to see, but the Texas swing has swung for 2022 and
it's gone.
It really paid for itself, I think.
Yeah, it's been a great couple of weeks down there in Texas, with brought us a lot of exciting golf to watch and such great coverage to watch that on. And I definitely was checking my scores on the PDGA app all weekend long on the course as well.
Jennifer, we had another really interesting thing happen over the weekend. It wasn't really a thing that happened, I guess. It was more the anniversary of the thing that happened. I don't even know if you're aware of this. I have a suspicion that you are, because I know that you're really proud of this accomplishment. 6 years ago, this past weekend, you set the still standing distance record for the FPO field. You've got it. This has got to be a story time. You got to let us in on this.
All right. I actually kind of got busy. I knew it was coming up, but was focusing on my round, and we had some early tee times and stuff out in San Diego. And so it wasn't until later in the day, sitting on the beach, resting and recapping, that I turned on Facebook and saw March 26, you know, 6 years ago, that was the day that I really did probably the hardest training of my life, and it paid off. And as a mother, you know, that's one of those things that, besides as a golfer, that I'm very proud of, is, you know, a mother or even a role model or whatever, you know, you can work hard and achieve reachable goals. And that was something I definitely trained a solid, extremely hard 6 months for, both strength training and repetition throwing and styles of throw. You can't really practice that style of throw as much accurately until you got out to Vegas. Definitely the distance throw out there is different than just throwing and getting your muscles ready for that type. Timing, you know, practicing my timing, even just into a net for, you know, 100 throws a day or whatever. But yeah, that was definitely a memory of my life that I will absolutely never forget.
I mean, come on, you literally have a poster of yourself hanging on the wall right now behind you.
Shh.
And what does it say there? It's got the distance. A lot of people don't know the distance.
It does. So it was 173.3 meters. And for our lovely people that go by feet, that is 568.5, which online, that poster says five. Online, when I looked it up, I think it's actually 0.6, but yeah.
Oh, well, what's a tenth of a foot between friends? 568.5 or 6 feet.
Yeah.
What were the conditions like that day? What was the lay of the land?
So they hold this out just south of Las Vegas. It's a very, very flat, dirt, dry, hard as concrete land. And what happens is, because you're kind of out there all day and you can pick when you throw depending on like wind changes and whatnot, there's one stake in the ground that is planted and you can rotate the other depending if the wind changes. So start of the day, middle of field, stake is planted. And if the wind changes, you know, you can rotate your angle to get, you know, that's the hard thing. It never fails. You go to a distance competition at Worlds or say Las Vegas and the wind is always wrong. So that is one great advantage, since literally this is a tournament only to throw distance. You know, that's something that they do to kind of make sure that we can succeed to the fullest, because that's why we're there. So day one, it was literally my very first throw. And it was pretty crazy. I was honored to have all of the top throwers there. You know, Simon was watching, Double G was there, Alex was there, Juliana got to see the throw and literally came up and was like, that was the prettiest throw I've ever seen. You know, so having those people there, even though, you know, I don't remember exactly how many people were there, 25 maybe or so, but having the top throwers in the world there with me to see me accomplish that also made it very special. The winds the first day were normal, I would say, 10 to 15, I think, on average. It was a little bit of a wind, but it wasn't windy. Day two was no wind at all. So we did, a lot of people don't know, a lot of the field events are also recorded there. And so day two was a field events day, kind of just for the women. The boys kind of stayed home and the women went out and had some fun. And then day three, so there's 3 days, you get three sets of five throws and that's it. And so day three was the extremely windy day. I gave it one shot. I goofing off on day two, hyperextended my elbow, trying to set the world record for overhand throw. Double hyperextended my elbow. So I wasn't really going to throw at all on day three, but I chose to throw one set. And for everyone out there, I'll go ahead and say this. Yes, wind can give you an advantage. However, I will strongly say go do it. Go out there when it's 40 miles per hour and see if you can throw further. Because I get so angry every year when this pops up and people are like, oh, the wind. Yes, the wind did allow him to throw this.
Talking about David Wiggins.
And Simon Lazat both had two incredible throws that went over 1,000 feet. I will say Simon's probably went just as far and was not seen, because it was a dirt field. And when you have wind blowing that far, and Simon always throws a peach colored boss, they literally couldn't see it land. So it couldn't get recorded, but he threw one. Oh,
because they're not counting skips. They're counting where it hits the ground. No, right. I see what you're saying.
Right,
sure.
Where it hits. So we found Simon's disc like 2 hours later driving around.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it wobbles. I mean, it was like a mile away, but it wobbles. So who knows how far it actually went.
I dream of the day that I can throw so far you have to drive around to find my that's never going to happen.
I'm sorry. It probably won't.
Unless I throw it into the bed of a passing pickup truck.
There you go.
That's how I'm going to set the world. Simon, I'm coming for you. More importantly, David, I'm coming for you.
Yeah, that day, the wind was so strong that there was literally, I would say, maybe five shots that went far.
Yeah.
You know, we all know. Just slammed the
rest. Sure.
Yeah. We all know how far Double G can throw. For the new listeners, you know, Alex is another incredible distance thrower. They literally couldn't get one off, you know, that probably they could throw, you know, a mid just as far. Because that wind, your angle has to be absolutely perfect, no room for error angle to get that disc to carry and catch the pocket of the wind. Above or below that pocket, it's smashing it down or flipping it over. So there were very, very few successful throws in that last day with the strong winds. But we all got some awesome throws. Day one was a perfect day. Simon, right after I threw, I think it was after I threw, not before, he also broke the existing record. So Simon and I both broke the distance record on day one.
And then David broke it again.
On day three. Yeah. Yeah.
On day three. I see. Well, fun times. I know you have to prepare to throw in a different style than you would in any other Correct. Circumstance. I know you throw discs that you might not usually throw in any other circumstance because you're going for a particular shot shape or a particular weight. But it's still really fun to work that hard for a specific goal and then to pay it off. So, yeah, it's 6 years. It's 6 years too late. And I know I knew you back then, but I never said back then, congratulations. So congratulations. Well, and let's see if this thing can't hold up another 6 years. Yeah,
I sure hope so. A fun little fact, too. The disc I broke the record with, Suzette brought down from the end of a factory. It was a factory second race. She just grabbed a handful of I think most of them were like 150.
Oh, lightweight.
So the one I threw was a 152 star Wraith, but I had never thrown that disc before.
Until that moment.
Yeah, I had trained with some Blizzard bosses like the boys use, and they're great as well. I actually still have one of those in my bag that I throw for forehands because it's a lightweight, great forehand disc. But that is not the one I broke the record with. Huh. So.
Well, I'd love to keep on reminiscing because it really is a lot of fun. But we've got a special guest in studio today talking about, if you follow us on Twitter at PDGA Radio, brought up a question last week regarding course design. And part of the motivation for that question was because of some new designs that we saw at Texas States this past weekend. Part of the motivation for that question, I will admit, is because I played a course not long ago. I'm not going to say where it is, but I travel a lot now, so don't think you know. But I played a course not long ago that was a fairly new course, and knowing that it was new and walking around and playing it, I found myself wondering, why did they do it that way? Why did they do this? Why did they do that? And rather than becoming some kind of an armchair course designer, Jennifer and I decided we would go right to the source. So we've got a special guest in studio today, Doug Bjerkus. He's the president of the board at Dynamic Discs. He is a course designer. He is a award-winning tournament director. And we're going to have ourselves a chat. So Jennifer and I posted a question on our Twitter account, PDGA Radio. Let me say that again. That would be at PDGA Radio. And the question was this. Say a new course goes into a park in your town and space is a little tight. Would you rather have 18 holes, but the layout's sort of mediocre? Or would you rather have 9 awesome holes? Well, we got a ton of responses to that question. As a matter of fact, we're gonna read through a few of those right now. At Grizzly Ginger DG, for example, says, give me the better layout with 9, please. If I want to play 18, I'll go through twice. So that's a great idea. He also mentions multiple tees or pin positions. So that's certainly one idea.
Yeah, we definitely do that a lot out here in Arizona. We have multiple courses that have 9 holes and you play them forwards and then you turn around and use the tees a different direction or a different tee going to those same baskets. So that's a pretty common thing we're starting to see a lot. Our next one here is Andy Dudalis.
Andy E. Dalis. Hey, Andy, you got to come up with an easier to read Twitter handle.
Yeah, sorry about that. A 1,000,000% this variety of courses locally and the 9-hole ones definitely don't feel worse than 18-hole ones simply by being less holes. Alternate tees or baskets can make a difference and really aren't even a huge deal if the 9 holes are solid.
I got to say, of the 70 or so responses we got, 97%+ were on the side of give me 9 great holes rather than 18, you know, lousy, tight, crammed in ones. Uncle Tootie at Uncle Tootie says, give me 13 or 14 holes. It doesn't have to be 9 or 18. I thought that was a pretty cool response.
I love how you always get the easy names. I think he does this on purpose.
What's this one? At the other James Dean, I think is what that says, Jen.
The land dictates the course, as it always has been. 18 is just a traditional of golf. No one has carved the number on sacred stone tablets or anything. If the land will accommodate 12 holes, then build 12 holes, and that's okay.
I agree with that. And finally, wanted to throw this one out there.
We know that
at
name.
Dana Disc Golf.
Yeah.
Yeah. At Dana Disc Golf, always a great commenter at the at PDGA Radio Twitter feed, actually says, I'm not sure if I like your wording here. Does mediocre mean we're talking unsafe or poorly designed? I think we can all agree that wouldn't be a good idea. Dana says 18 beginner friendly holes are great and can be awesome. And I certainly agree. I didn't mean to imply that the 18 holes that beginner friendly was somehow negative. But the fact of the matter is this opened up a huge can of worms, a great big topic on course design in general. So as Jen and I like to do, we go seeking for an expert on the topic. And I think we found one. Doug Bjerkus, president of the board at Dynamic Discs, former TD of the Dynamic Discs Open, will be acting as assistant TD this year at the Dynamic Discs Open, coming up literally 1 month from today. Doug, thanks for joining us this afternoon on this interesting topic.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So talking about disc golf course design in general, but obviously you have plenty of specific examples, including adjustments to the course that'll be used at DDO and then later on at Pro Worlds this year. So I don't even know where to begin because I know that you've got just a wealth of information for us on the topic. So maybe we should start here. Maybe we should start with just the whole process of designing or redesigning a course. We've got a lot of listeners that are newer to the game of disc golf, brand new members of the PDGA that might not know the complications that go into a good disc golf course. It's a lot more than just sticking baskets in the ground, isn't it?
It is. I wish it was that simple, but it's not just sticking baskets in the ground. I think the most important thing that any community or disc golf group or individual that's looking to put a disc golf course in is to really think through what the goal is, what the mission of that course is going to be. It's a whole different ballgame if your goal is to design a course that would one day host a disc golf pro tour event or a PDGA major. Then let's say you're designing a 9-hole course for your community just to get involved and to learn and have another activity to do. That those two courses are 100% different from each other. And I sure. think a lot of people sometimes do go into a design project and they really don't have a clear focus or a clear mission. And I think that's super important to know. What is it that I'm set out to do here? Is it to get my local community out and active playing disc golf, exposed to a new recreational activity, or is it to host tournaments, and that could be just C tiers and B tiers, or is it, you know, eventually going to be something that, you know, a course that could become a household name like a Maple Hill or an Emporia Country Club where it's just known for having big events. Totally different process for designing those.
What kinds of things have to be done before you even place that order for new baskets?
Boy, well, you want to make sure you can put the course there. And I've heard horror stories of people that have actually planted baskets in the ground and never gotten any type of permission to put them there. Well, that's okay if it's private property and it's your private property. But if it's not, you want to make sure that whether it's owned by a school or owned by a city, perhaps it's a park. You know, one of the things I know is super challenging in all disc golf communities is putting courses on shared spaces where it's shared by dog walkers and playground users and fishers and all kinds of other stuff that might be going on at the park. So, you know, just getting the approval to say, hey, this is private property. I need to make sure the owner's okay with this, or this is public property. I need to make sure that whatever the sanctioning body is that oversees that, whether it's Parks Department or a city or a county, that they're like, yes, this is okay. So first step, get approval.
First step.
It's not, you know, there's an old saying, it's easier to seek forgiveness than it is permission. It's really hard to seek forgiveness, though, when you put 18 baskets and concrete tee pads onto land you don't have the right to do so on.
I think that's one of the major problems, though, is just actually finding good land. You know, whether the city parks by now, most all have some type of playground or gazebo basketball courts or just walking paths. And so finding good, safe land for us to put a course on is really becoming a problem.
Mm-hmm. And in more and more cases, they're landlocked pieces of land too. If it is a city park, it's already expanded as far as it can and it's been built around. So then what do you do?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think a lot more people have probably been hurt by discs that are being thrown 400 plus feet, you know, as opposed to discs that are maybe thrown 180 to 240 feet. And I think that a lot of the courses that go into mixed use places like city parks and things like that, I don't think the focus should be on big, long, dangerous blind holes, but perhaps those parks should focus on, hey, this is going to be a fun activity in the park that might get people involved in disc golf, might get them some early satisfaction with maybe a birdie on a 180-foot hole. Could you imagine going out to the Emporia Country Club and that being your first disc golf experience?
Wow.
And then come back. They'd be like, okay, yeah, thanks for showing me that sport. I'm going to go, play cornhole or something. So it's important to realize that. But I, you know, back to the land, Jennifer, you mentioned this, is, you know, I see us moving towards a deal where, you know, courses, it's pretty obvious what type of course it is. It's either on private land or on a single use piece of land where it is a disc golf course, period. It's not a dog park. It's not anything else.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think I see us too in the future going to a lot more big tournaments at ball golf courses for that reason of spectatorship, safety, you know, just having our sport going at that time, because otherwise these city parks are great fun courses, but doesn't put us at the level, you know, like you said, it depends on what we're trying to accomplish. But now more than ever, you can definitely see the split of what is this course going to be, or even as much as it's getting into the school systems, you know, a nice short, maybe 3 or 6 hole course near schools.
Yep.
So there's definitely going to be, top priority of deciding from the get-go. It's not going to be extended down the road or different places for a disc golf pro tour event. It's going to either be a small city course for beginners or elite level.
Yep. And I would argue that those small city courses, maybe even like a 9-hole course, like your original Twitter question had to deal with, that those courses are as important and as critical to the growth of our sport as those single-use plots of land that can handle thousands of spectators and can challenge the best pros in the world. You need them both for our sport to continue to accelerate. And so if you are considering putting in a course in, don't feel like if you're not designing the next elite series, you know, course, that's okay. You're still doing your part to grow our sport by putting 9 holes into a park that anyone can learn how to play on and really have a good experience with that. I can share with you in Emporia, when I first got here 6 years ago, we were clearly just focused on big courses. Mm-hmm. We need to run tournaments. We need to have people come to Emporia. We have a national tour event. We've hosted world championships. We need these big courses. And I was always kind of shocked here in town when before I moved here, I used to come here to play what used to be the Glassblown Open, and the place was packed and it was like a disc golf utopia. Well, I moved here and I was, all I'd ever known Emporia to be was the tournament Emporia. And we got here and I remember my wife and I went to Jones Park to play golf like our second day after moving here. And we're like, where is everybody? We were like the only people on the course. And it was like we had spent so much time focusing on big courses. And again, back to that analogy of going out to Emporia Country Club for your first round of golf, what a disaster that would be. We put Hammond Park in the ground, which is a 9-hole course, ironically, literally across the street from the country club.
Yeah.
No water. You're not going to lose a disc. It's fun. It's in the shade. It's short. Mm-hmm. A new disc golfer could get a birdie early in their disc golf career, which I think success breeds success, and you want to be able to give people that satisfaction.
Sure.
That course has single-handedly grown our local leagues. We have a women's league now. We have more and more tournaments that are held out there. Fundraiser events for local charities are held on that course. It's huge. And again, as you guys know and our listeners know, that you know, you get discs into people's hands and they can experience playing, they're very likely going to stick with it. And that's what we want. We just want more people playing. So kudos to those that design the short 9-hole courses. Kudos to those that design those big monster tracks that we can watch all these 10, 50 rated guys throw. very much not like the way I throw.
Well, and to that point, every one of these courses has a different set of priorities. You mentioned these longer courses, these championship, as we say, courses. You know, a unique element to those, even, that is changing as we speak, it feels like, is the fact that they need to handle not only the kind of layout that's going to challenge a professional disc golfer of, say, Jennifer's ability. They need to be able to handle all of those fans that want to be there to watch somebody like Jennifer play, not just one round, but three or even four or even more rounds over the course of an event. That could be, I don't know, 1,500 fans, spectators.
Easily.
Yeah. Easily, if not more. And there are all of the logistics of that. So that's, you know, priorities on that end of the spectrum. And you just mentioned the priorities on the other end, which is beginner friendly and exposure to the sport. It's just kind of mind blowing.
Yeah, no, the whole spectator piece is crazy. I can remember running some events in Denver and thinking, you know, how cool would it be if a whole bunch of people were just here watching, or even better than that, if they were paying to watch, because that suddenly allows a tournament director or a club or whoever's running an event to have a lot more revenue that they can make the tournament even better with. And man, it's like 10 years later, we wake up and it's now commonplace to charge spectators mm-hmm. to watch golf. I can remember someone going, oh my, you can't charge for me to watch golf, you know, blah, 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 you know. And it's funny, some of the people that say that are the ones that were like, we need to grow the sport. Well, sometimes growing the sport involves some changes and it's, you know, I don't go to a Cincinnati Reds game expecting to get in for free. I mean, it's just this sport is becoming a legitimate, close to mainstream sport, and things have to change. And so if you are designing a course for the potential of eventually hosting a big, big event, or if you want that course to be a course that the pros go, oh my gosh, that is such a track, so challenging. It requires all the different shots in a bag, et cetera, et cetera. Also add to your list as far as the goals that you need to accomplish when you design that course to, hey, what's the flow going to look like for people that are watching?
Right.
You know, and I also, here's another thing that I'm super excited about. And of course, the Dynamic Disc Open, I remember when registration opened for it a couple, 3 months ago in the MPO field, and I think in the FPO field, they both filled right away, and the MPO was all 1,000 rated or above golfers, and the FPO was all 900 and above disc golfers. We are getting mm-hmm. more and more players that are becoming household names that are at events. I know the broadcasters yesterday on the Texas State Championships, during their broadcast, they were talking about how there were 10-30 guys that weren't getting paid.
Mm.
And it's getting to the point where it used to be, I remember 15, 20 years ago, if I went to a B tier where a name brand or a household name pro was playing, they were on the lead card and you followed the lead card around and that was all you did. I had the privilege of attending the Masters ball golf tournament back in 1992. I'm dating myself. Fred Couples won.
That's right.
Woo, cool. He's one of my favorites.
We did not follow any groups. We camped out and got a comfortable seat and watched the same hole over and over again and saw name brand or, you know, household names just coming through group mm-hmm. after group. And I think disc golf's becoming the same way, where you're going to stop seeing these massive crowds just following one card. And yes, it's awesome to watch that last card, but I think there can be a lot of value for the fan. And this is when you're designing a course. Think about that. Is there a place for some bleachers? Is there a place where there's a large out of bounds area that could maintain a bunch of people sitting on blankets on a hill? Mm-hmm. I mean, think that stuff through. Don't just think about the shots and the lines and the par of a hole, but think about all of that periphery stuff. And if you can get the perfect hole designed, it's not only going to challenge the pros and test them, but it's also going to provide a great atmosphere to watch golf. And Grant, you mentioned earlier about ball golf courses and being kind of popular for that type of stuff. I think one of the reasons they are popular is that they tend not to need to use the entire course, which leaves a lot of space for spectating. They also tend to not be as wooded. And this, of course, is one of the age-old arguments in disc golf. What's better, to have a tight wooded course that tests every last ounce of a disc golfer's energy and not have fans be able to spectate? Or is it to have them in somewhat of a little bit more open area, or maybe parts of the course are open where you can allow for live spectators? So I don't know the exact answer to all these questions, but there's sure a lot of things to think about if you want to design a disc golf course.
Well, and that's why it's okay, I think, to go from event to event and have each event have its own sort of identity and its own characteristics and even allows for different combinations of players to excel, both at the amateur and the pro level. I'm just thinking through courses in my area and how dramatically different some of them are. And there are some that I, in my very amateur state, feel pretty good about myself. And there are others that if I go play an event there, I'm doing it for fun because I'm not going to be very competitive at that particular track.
Well, and now more than ever, you know, this huge spike in growth of our sport, planning future courses, I think we have to, you know, plan for that growth in advance, not fix it later. You know, if anyone's ever drove through Texas, you know, how many lanes did they have that they weren't using for so many years? It was always under construction. And it's like, why is there three extra lanes they're not even using? But they were planning for growth. They knew that the growth was going to happen. And I think disc golf designing is kind of going to have to go that way for future courses. Is we know the numbers and the different variety of levels of skill are going to be greater now more than ever. So I think that'll be another thing that designers will have to kind of look into more.
Let me tell you the background that prompted me to post that question on Twitter, because I'm going to kind of admit something here. I was playing a course that I knew for a fact was a fairly new course. I'm not going to say where it is because I don't want to sound like I'm being critical of this particular locale, but I was playing a course, and as I played it, knew it was fairly new, I found myself looking around and going, why did they make that decision? Why is this hole over here? It seems like a terrible place to put a hole. Why are they doing this? Why are they doing that? And I found myself kind of armchair course designing, not armchair quarterbacking, armchair course designing. And then I sort of stopped myself and thought, there are so many things that I don't know. I don't know what limitations this particular city might have put on them and told them areas of the park they couldn't design in. I don't know what limitations they might have had financially or from a safety standpoint that I couldn't see, you know, during that first round, you know, safety issues or something like that. Can you speak a little bit to the kinds of challenges that the average player might not know about when it comes to putting in a course? And here's maybe a first example. Maybe the average player new to the game or that's been playing for years doesn't know how expensive it is to put a course in.
Yeah, that's a great question. Everything costs money, obviously. And sometimes the least expensive thing on a disc golf course is to put down the concrete and to put down the anchor, you know, for a tee pad, and then put the anchor for where the basket's going to go. It's as soon as you elevate a tee or you need some landscaping because you want your tee to be flat and it's going to be on the side of a hill, suddenly there's a couple $1,000s, you know, or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it might be. It just keeps adding up and adding up and adding up. Also, it's not as easy as if you have a, you know, 100 acres of hilled, wooded ponds, streams, creeks, all the stuff that everyone loves to see in a disc golf hole, and you are starting from scratch. That also is way easier than if you have a certain set of things you've got to follow first. So, for instance, if you go to your local city park, whoever designed that course, probably the first thing they thought about is where are people going to park. Uh-huh. And that's where hole one should probably be. And that's where hole 18's basket should probably finish near there. Mm-hmm. I can't stand pulling into a parking lot. You're next to hole six. And you're like, well, where the heck is one? Mm-hmm. I wanted to make one right here. This is dumb. but that course designer. And if you're that mm-hmm. person, I'm sorry. But I didn't mean to call you dumb. but on a serious note, that's the first thing you think about. Okay, where's it going to start? Where's it going to end? Then another thing that you got to think about is that one of my most proud moments in disc golf was actually designing a course in Denver, Colorado called Colorado Heights University. And for many, many years, well, for like 4 years, it was arguably the best course in Denver. It was on a campus that I was actually employed by, and the campus was almost dead. There wasn't anything going on the campus, so it was really easy to facilitate putting a disc golf course there. But unfortunately, both the disc golf course started growing rapidly as well as the campus itself. Mm. And more people ended up on the campus. And suddenly there was just way too much conflict to have it be both a college campus as well as a disc golf course. And the course ended up getting pulled. But when we designed that course, the very first thing we did is we thought about, okay, where can it start? And then we looked for what would be the amazing, mind-blowing holes. Mm-hmm. And you find out where those are going to be. And sometimes you're at a park and you're like, I don't know if you guys have ever played a course where you see like why in the world did they not put a hole right here? This is flipping amazing. And there could be some reasons why they didn't, but if you catch those amazing holes first and you start with your hole one and your hole 18 or your hole one and your hole nine, you can then start piecing together something. There's a phrase we probably use way too often in disc golf. It's called filler holes. You guys have probably heard that term. Mm-hmm. You've got these amazing holes that you put in the ground and you need a filler hole to make it work.
Yeah.
And the trade-off is you can complain about that and you can go, oh my gosh, this is just a filler hole. Well, think about it this way. If that filler hole wasn't there, maybe that rock star hole wouldn't be in the ground. So those are things to think about and things that as players, we just go in and go, man, I wish this was the best course I ever played. But there are a lot of things that go into it. There's a lot of, you know, sometimes you got to think about the line that people would throw a hole and someone could say, why is there not a hole here? This would be perfect. And maybe there's a playground that's right on the edge of the fairway and a smart course designer is going to go, as beautiful as this could be, this course will get pulled quicker than you can say lickety split if kids start getting hit on a playground by flying discs. So lots of things go into it.
Well, and I like to also remind people that mandos are only enforceable when someone's there to enforce them. So at a tournament, sure, it's easy to enforce that mando. But on a Tuesday afternoon, if somebody goes there and maybe the mando's not well marked when there's not a tournament, then you never know when someone might be throwing discs right over a playground or right over a busy street. And you can't police that other than to simply design the hole in another location. That's a consideration that I think sometimes players don't realize that's what's had to happen. Yeah, it looks great. It would be cool to throw over there, but the other 98% of the time, we have to keep people from throwing over there no matter what.
Yep. How many times, Doug, have you heard, oh, but there's usually never anyone here?
Yeah, exactly.
I've heard that so many times, but there's never anyone here. I'm like, but the one time,
yep,
a sweet little lady pushing a baby stroller is going to be there. Yep. And that will be the one time that someone throws a bad shot.
Yeah. And a high-speed driver flying at 80 miles per hour, like some of these people can throw it, it's dangerous. We got to be aware of that as we design courses.
Doug, what has your experience been in working with civic organizations like a city parks and recs department? Has it been mostly positive? Has it been a mix?
It's been a mix. I know in Denver, it was a little more difficult to work with the parks department, but I think that's because of scale. Here in Emporia, It's a joy because this entire and Emporia is a bad example for a lot of things because it's kind of the perfect storm here. But the parks department here has been awesome to work with, and they're really supportive of disc golf. They see the economic impact of the sport. But of course, that happened over several years of having a disc golf company start here, running a lot of events, running bigger events. It's the economic impact of disc golf is definitely recognized here in Emporia. Whereas if in Denver, Colorado, you talk to a parks department, I don't care if you bring 500 people to town for a big event in Denver, Colorado, it's going to be a blip on the economic impact radar. You got to bring in like the Republican National Convention to the stadium to start making an impact there. But or the Democratic. That wasn't meant to be political.
But it was, Doug. It was.
I'll tell you what's been the best for us. And I can remember in Texas when I lived down there, if there's somebody in the parks department that likes disc golf,
you're in.
Man,
huge.
So easy to get the lid off of the jar.
Definitely, I mean, someone you take cookies to.
Yes. And so everyone out there that's wanting more courses in your community, get to know the local parks department guys and take them out for drinks, teach them how to play disc golf and get them fired up. And you've got them in.
Well, and for other listeners, too, I think, you know, if you don't know Emporia and you haven't been there, well, first of all, you should go. But second of all, how we keep talking about these beginner courses are so important. Emporia is what it is because the town accepted and loves disc golf. And I think if you are a town who wants to try to someday, you know, get to that level, having a lot of those courses that make the town fall in love with the sport, I think is where you have to begin. And then you can hopefully get those huge, you know, even just one elite course, but maybe 10 small beginner courses that makes the entire town get behind that sport.
Grant mentioned earlier schools, you know, or maybe Jennifer, you did it. One of the three guys did the
whole
course. That was Jennifer's.
That's another great way to get invested in a town is if you get kids that are enjoying it and they're playing, then they're going to want to have bigger challenges than just the three baskets that are surrounding the elementary school or whatever. And, I'm telling you, it's not just going to the city and going, we need a disc golf course. You got to go to the schools. You got to do clinics. You got to grow the sport in lots of mm-hmm. different ways. And when you get that upswell, and what a great time to be doing it right now, because we're showing up on CBS Sports and ESPN, and the numbers, just every time you turn around, it seems like we got more people watching live disc golf than we've ever had watching before. And we need to leverage all of that if we want to continue to grow the sport and get more courses in the ground. So I also, Grant, think data is a big point. Every time we've gone to talk about getting a new course in the ground, whether it's been here in Emporia or in other places that I've lived, having some sort of deck or presentation that's professional that, you know, talks about the benefits of the course, what the course can bring. You know, one thing, I remember the very first course I ever worked on designing or working on helping get installed was Will Hare Park in Abilene, Texas. And I remember we had an 18-hole course at Cal Young, which is where I learned how to play. And then the city was very supportive of getting into Will Hare Park, not so much because they loved disc golf, but because there was some questionable activities going on in that park. And that's another kind of pro tip is if you're looking to get a disc golf course into an area, oftentimes we look at, oh, this is the nicest, most beautiful park ever. Man, go look at the worst park that's in town that has all the maybe not real pleasant things going on in it. And traffic in a park, good traffic, and disc golf is good traffic, will eliminate the bad traffic, which is the unwanted behavior that cities oftentimes are trying to figure out. How do we get all these people out of the park? Mm-hmm. And disc golf might be
moved. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we have that in Oklahoma City as well. So that is a pretty common thing. That's why they brought the courses in and support it. A couple of the times that I've been asked to design courses were actually because it was a school project, or like we talked about, an Eagle project. I did one down in Lexington, Oklahoma, and the lady contacted me. She had an honors group of kids, and that was the project that she picked. She had never played disc golf. This was way before the sport was huge. That teacher was absolutely incredible, raised all the money. She had, you talked about concrete and all the little price, you know, cost things to put in a course. She went to a concrete company and had them donate any extra after, you know, they finished a site. You know, they put in a house. Well, there's this much left over. Well, that was donated to put in tee pads. She had, believe it or not, contacted the prisoners from our Lexington prison, came out, did the labor to put the pads in. So it was the most cost efficient course I think that was ever put in. Unfortunately, the land was, you know, very, very tight. But, you know, these schools want this just as much as we do. And so if everyone really starts working together, I think we're going to have a lot more amazing courses around town.
Yeah. You know, I think it's funny. We started talking about actually designing courses, and now we're talking about how to the sport to getting more courses in the ground just in general. But I think a huge untapped market moving forward too is churches that have a lot of property. I know down in Tyler, Texas, where the big event was just this past weekend, I know there's two churches down there that have courses that are used for flex start C tiers and things like that. And a lot of churches have a lot of land that can be used. Churches generally have everything from kids to teenagers to college kids to mm-hmm. young adults to old adults, et cetera. And of course, our sport reaches all of those entities. But that's another great, great pitch. And, you know, I was talking to somebody from a church that indicated that, you know, we were talking about what we loved about disc golf. And I mentioned that, you know, really throwing the disc is only about 5 to 10% of a round of disc golf. The athletic event of disc golf is really a very small part. The rest of your time, or the majority of your time, is walking and talking and building relationships and having fun with people. And of course, churches are big on that kind of stuff. And it's just a perfect way to get people together, just building relationships. And I think that sometimes we sell the athletic part of disc golf, you know, pretty hard and heavy. But man, that in this day and age where so much is done via like Zoom calls and, you know, things like that, that actually getting with other human beings and experiencing life on a disc golf course is very underrated.
Yeah, a little bit of sunshine.
I'll take that the exact opposite way as well, that this sport is good for everyone, is the people who like to be alone.
Yep.
You know, a lot of these schools that I go into, believe it or not, the non-athletic
subset.
You know, I won't stereotype anyone, but you can tell that these people maybe don't run in big crowds. They don't play any other sport. They don't participate in PE. But when I just take 2 seconds and show them how to do it, and they can easily, they're hooked. Yep. And that gives that kid something to do. Maybe that's going to keep him out of trouble. So that is what's so great about this sport, and why, you know, so many of us love it, is it's for everyone, mm-hmm. young, old, athletic, not mm-hmm. athletic. Anyone can play this sport for life.
Yep. And what's even cooler than that is that you can take the best disc golfer in the world and somebody who has never played a hole of disc golf and put them on the same card, and they can enjoy themselves. Where if you take
absolutely
4 seasoned basketball players and 1 person that's never played basketball, and you try to put the 5 of them together on the court, bad things are going to happen.
Just not
That guy's never going to touch the ball.
And so it's an individual sport, but it's also, it's just awesome. We wouldn't be here on this podcast here if it wasn't awesome, would we?
That's right.
Well, Doug, as we start to sort of land the plane, what do you see being some future trends when it comes to disc golf course design? You mentioned when it comes to professional caliber courses, you mentioned trends that take into account the need to accommodate spectators. You just now mentioned the idea of maybe seeing more and more courses on pieces of property that we haven't seen them as much in the past, like church property, for example, or more and more at certain schools. What other trends do you see, not only in terms of where the courses go, but within the design of disc golf holes themselves? What do you see coming in the next, say, I don't know, 3 to 5 years?
Well, that's kind of a tough question. I think what I'll do is I'll answer that for championship level courses first.
Okay,
it's
sure.
Totally different. But we've just went through kind of a renaissance of change here locally with both what used to be Jones Gold and what has been the Country Club, where we have historically had holes for MPO and FPO. And the difference is that, and I think there needs to be a difference in a lot of holes like that. You want a course that's good for the group that's playing it, and the
sure.
the statistics for the FPO players versus the MPO players is there are some differences there. And we used to do a lot of second tee pads. We would throw to the same basket, but we'd always have multiple tee pads. And with the way the sport has grown and the way that courses are getting dressed up with tents near tee pads and feather flags and signs and the things that make everything look so professional, and I think it's great for our sport, you have a shorter pad that's, you know, 100 feet up the fairway for the FPO division. And if you start putting tents and flags and signs up there, they're right in the middle of the fairway for the MPO division. And we sure. found that we weren't able to dress up a lot of the FPO short pads because of that very mm-hmm. thing. And we have started to make the shift. And actually, I can remember having a talk with Sean Sinclair about this about a year ago as we were preparing for the World's Championship at the end of in August of this year. And we have switched and said, hey, let's use the same tee pad where we can make it awesome, but let's do 2 separate pins. And if we need to make a hole shorter. And so like at the Country Club, we've had tons of holes that had 2 pads and 1 pin. Well, this year you're going to see most of them having 1 pad and 2 pins. And if there are mm-hmm. 2 separate pads, they are so far away from each other that they can, you know, I'm making a lot of hand gestures.
That's all right.
Screen, and I'm realizing that it's all just for naught because this is
no.
An audio presentation.
It's but, the theater of radio.
But
I'm a hand talker too.
in some cases, and I think this is important for design, if you are thinking about a championship course, if you are going to use 2 tee pads, could they be spread out far enough to where you can dress them both up so that when the cameras are on them, and that's important. I mean,
sure.
the whole camera piece to our sport, I mean, think about this. I've watched thousands of Minnesota Vikings football games on television. I've seen them live about a dozen times. I've seen them way more times on television, and that's where you become a fan, the same thing's going to happen with our sport as we grow. So you've got to think about mm-hmm. camera angles and how can this be shot? And, it, you know, that's why it's so critical to, if you're going to have multiple tee pads, to make sure that they don't interfere with each other. Mm-hmm. That's a big piece. And then Grant and Jennifer, we already talked about the spectating. Finding ways to put spectators in designated areas. In fact, we're trying something for the first time this year. At the country club, we have, I think, 30,000 feet of rope and posts that will be set up throughout that course that will clearly separate the playing surface from where spectators can be. There won't be any need for people carrying the string around to kind of manage the crowd. It's these are the areas your nice. Ticket allows you in. Enjoy yourself. This is the area where the players and one caddy for each player can be. Enjoy yourself there. And that needs to be thought about. If your goal is to have one of these championship level courses, it's going to be, mm-hmm. you know, going to have the greatest players in the world play on it. You got to remember spectators.
And at all time, or as much as possible, I should say, in those areas, can they try to watch multiple holes like on that plays on both sides? Like they're in the middle and maybe the hole's going both directions.
Yep, that's yeah. correct. And then we're also utilizing several sets of bleachers throughout the course. And again, this goes back to what we were talking about when I brought up the Masters is, you know, I think over time you're going to stop seeing people just following one group all over the course to where, hey, I'm going to grab a seat. I mean, imagine sitting in the bleachers looking at the island hole number 16 at the country club yeah. on Sunday this year. Man, I'd be thoroughly entertained yeah. just hanging out there the whole day. So, yeah, got to think about all of that.
For anyone who watches the waste management, you know, this is it the 17th green here oh, yeah. at the waste 16, management. And it yeah. actually, I
is
think
it 16, it's 16. Is it 17? I don't know.
I think it's 17.
I think we know what you're talking about.
It got aced this year. There was a hole in one and it literally took a lot of time and a ton of people mm-hmm. to clear that green because everyone who had any kind of beverage, alcohol mostly, in their hands, it was on the green. And I mean, so, but that's literally, those people go there, they interview them on the news, they go there at 3-4 in the morning to get a seat on that hole. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how cool would that be one day that people are literally camping out to get that spot on the 18th green?
Jennifer, I'll say it's not how cool would that be, it's how cool will that be.
It gave me goosebumps.
We will get to the point where those tickets are premium, where, hey, yeah. I've got a seat here, and that they're going to buy it year after year after year. Disc golf is an amazing, amazing spectator sport. And mm-hmm. we just haven't noticed it because there was never spectators. We've just always right. been playing. If you're at an event where the top pros are, you're probably like an intermediate player playing 18 holes behind them or whatever. But
yeah.
spectating is the real deal, and we've got to be conscientious about it.
Well, you can see the disc in flight.
Yep.
For those of you on the fence too, you know, like we talked about, it's a free public park. I can go, you know, and don't want to pay that amount. Also know that money, I believe for most all of these tournaments that offer spectator passes, goes to the payout. So we go back to, you know, the circle of life here. We're growing the sport. If you want to see the sport get to the next level, we have to bring in that money. And, you know, that's big sponsorships, you know, donations, whatever, but it's also in these spectator passes.
Doug, let's talk about between the ropes as we wrap up. We talked about everything kind of outside the ropes in terms of designing with cameras in mind, designing with spectators in mind. What do you see happening or needing to happen to challenge the ever increasing capabilities of players, both at a pro, but also, you know, it used to be a middling amateur was nowhere near as good as a middling amateur is now. So what do you see happening? And you can use the upcoming DDO courses and world courses as your example. What is needing to be done to continue to challenge today's players?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think you need to make sure that you are balancing everything together when you're designing that course and you're putting those holes in and determining the pars. Determining a par on a course is on a hole is an important process as well. But, you know, you always hear, oh, it's a bomber course. So it's just going to the people that can throw far, that's going to benefit them. You know what? Throwing far is a skill that if you've got it, and your opponents don't, there should be some advantages to throwing far. Should there be advantages to throwing far on all 18 holes that you're playing? Absolutely not. But there should be some of those holes where you're rewarded because of that skill set. Same thing with putters. If you're an outstanding putter, you should have risky greens. You know, I know there's some people out there that say there needs to be a 10 meter circle around every green and it needs to be safe and there shouldn't be any obstacles in that 10 meter circle. I get that. And I think it kind of makes sense. But I also think it also makes a lot of sense to have a basket that's maybe 14 feet from being out of bounds. And now you're rewarding those that have precision around the putting green. If you can have a couple holes, I know at the Emporia Country Club, everyone that's familiar with hole 9, you throw through the tunnel and it curls up to the right. Then you used to come out of the woods and you'd throw straight down at the hole that I believe Brian Earhart aced, to hole number 10 out at the country club. We moved the D-pad to that hole into the woods, back where 9's green is, and carved out a long tunnel shot. And again, you need some of that on a hole where you reward accuracy with your mid-range game. I mean, you really want to think about all the skill sets that make a player great and find a way to stir that all up to where you're testing each of those things, not just one of those things, but each of those things throughout the course. And I think you're able to crown a worthy champion if you have that. It can't just be, oh, it's all this way. You know, it's one of the reasons why at the country club we have so much artificial OB. I mean, I think at ball golf courses, they're great for spectators and they're great for cell service usually, and they're great for all those things we need to cover disc golf, but they may not have the technical challenge. And sometimes you have to artificially create that. And if that means creating some out of bounds, it's, you know, paint lines or flag lines or string lines or whatever it may be. That's another way to test to make sure that the champion of your event is somebody that has all of those tools and that they can put it all together. So, I think I wasn't a fan of elevated baskets at first. 5 years ago, I thought it was kind of gimmicky, but I'm actually starting to see the value in those as I've seen the Disc Golf Pro Tour kind of grow with those. Again, changing the way that you putt a little bit. I like the fact that people are experimenting with different rules, like bunker rules, for instance. That's another way to in between the ropes, kind of tighten something up. And maybe it's not OB, but it's, you know, there's a penalty for landing there. It's not stroke and distance. It's just stroke at that point. Mm-hmm. So lots of things you can do, but you got to think about those things and you gotta understand the game. And I'd encourage anybody that's wanting to develop disc golf courses and design disc golf courses, the absolute best thing you can do is play disc golf. Get out there and play tournaments. Go see lots of courses, take notes, say, man, that is awesome. I need to do that the next course I'm going to design. And then you see something that's awful and you're like, okay, that's never going to happen on a course I'm going to design. Just soak it all in and good things will happen.
I think that's awesome advice. One thing that I've always struggled with or that irritated me, I guess I should say, is a course designer that thinks it's a tough hole because it's impossible to score on. You know, like, oh, look at this hole. It's so hard. You know, no one can get, you know, a 3 on it and it's only 200 feet. That's not a good hole. You know, like you were talking about on making us use our skills, every hole should have a line. And I personally think should have at least 2, you know, whether that be a forehand or a lefty or a straight shot or, you know, a more of a right hand dominant line. Every hole needs at least 1, preferably 2, clear lines that make us choose that shot and execute. Mm-hmm. And I think that to me is what makes a really good hole. Not that no one can birdie it. That's not a good hole.
And the whole deal with a hole that no one can birdie, I agree with you 100% there, Jennifer. And it's not always taking a par 4 and saying, well, let's just make it a par 5. Because that's not all. Because a hole that nobody can get a 4 on might be a hole that almost everybody can get a 5 on.
Right.
So maybe it's moving a basket 40 feet. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that blows my mind about course design change. The last hole at the country club, hole 18, the FPO pad, is a finishing hole that I think we ran the stats on it and like 5% of the entire field birdied it.
Right.
And it's not birdieable. We're moving that pad forward, I think 37 feet. And based on that distance, just 37 feet, you don't think about that being a huge difference, but man, that's over 10% of the length of that hole. And suddenly now it does become a little more approachable. It doesn't mean everyone's going to birdie it. But it's definitely little things like that. Sometimes the devil's in the detail, and 30 feet here, 30 feet there, 30 feet into the woods as opposed to 30 feet out of the woods. I mean, it's crazy, all those things that impact the way a hole will play.
And you brought up filler holes earlier. I think you can agree with me on this as well. Those are the holes we mess up as pros. Those short holes are the ones I almost played a clean, perfect round yesterday to finish my tournament. The one hole that I warmed up on that was the easiest hole probably for me was my only bogey yesterday, you know? And so those short, easy holes are the ones sometimes that can cause us the most trouble, not the par fives.
Yeah.
So
Jennifer, was that a par three that you were playing?
Yeah.
Yeah. So here's
island.
Everyone can benefit from this. When I play disc golf, I just add one to the par and I feel so much better than that's what you need to do in that case.
That's what I've been doing.
It's funny. We literally were talking. So I played Daniel Bo in San Diego this weekend and we were discussing the TD Mark and I and a few others about a lot of this stuff. And Mark does an incredible job of what can I do to make it better? I think that's the most incredible TD, not the one who's like, my tournament's the best. The best tournaments are the ones that the TDs are like, is there anything else that I can do to make this tournament better? And we talked about a lot of this. You know, he has several baskets that the OB is it may be 30 feet, but the ground there is so hard, it feels like it's 5 feet. You know, I did not run a lot of birdie opportunities because it wasn't worth the risk for me. So we were talking about that, like maybe making them shorter where it is or not. How would we force people to want to go for those instead of just laying everything up and making it boring golf? And we were actually talking about him pushing those tight OB lines back a little bit to make us try to go for those birdies more. But that course is really the ground. The ground is worse than day law. Like it is literally, you lay up and you can skip 30 feet pretty easy. There was a hole there. It's actually hole one, depending on how you play it. But it's a three is just really probably not going to happen. But a five, you kind of feel bad that you get a five and it's a par four. There's some of those even par fours or fives that are tweeners that you really can't do anything with. Like,
yep.
Change in the par, really, there's just some of those that are kind of tweeners. But maybe that's the time that 30 feet makes it not feel like such a tweener hole. It's a great hole. Yep. You know, it's a wonderful, well-designed, hard, difficult, challenging hole. But I bet there was probably maybe not even one MPO player that took a three on it. Yep. And it's a par four.
Yep. Yeah. And if you look at the data that comes out of UDisc or whatever on a course and you see a specific hole and all this data is there, which is awesome. And you have a hole where 90% of the field all gets the exact same score. Why are you guys playing?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe a hole that needs some attention. Well, Doug, again, we thank you so much for spending all of this time with us today. We got so detailed, which I'm thrilled about. And we're going to get to see some of that detail in action here when we see you again in just a matter of weeks at the Dynamic Disc Open. So that's going to be really exciting for us and really exciting for all of our listeners. By the way, before I let you go, I think if I read this correctly over the weekend, it was a tweet, I think, that I saw. Congratulations in order for Dynamic. Was Ricky the first ever MPO victor on the Disc Golf Pro Tour for Dynamic Discs?
You know what? I think you may be correct. We've had on the FPO side, we've had winners, but I think that is correct. And man, we love having Ricky with us. It's just was really exciting to see that, and we're thinking that's the one of many, many more this year. Really pleased. We've got a couple other new players: Mason Ford, Chris Clemens has had a great season so far. Gavin is coming back from an injury. He's a new player for us. So yeah, we got a lot of exciting things going on here, and we couldn't be more happy than to see Ricky win that tournament. And I tell you what's crazy is he's played in six Texas State Championships and won them all. So I mean that's just
right.
crazy.
at different venues, by the way. Some people don't know that gets played at different venues. So he just loves that, that Texas wind, I guess. Well, once again, Doug, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. We appreciate it. We'll see you in a few weeks.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Doug. Well, that's going to wrap up our very last March episode. Next time you join us on PDGA Radio, we will be in April 2022.
No fooling.
In like a lion, out like a lamb. So watch out, everybody. We're about to be some lions coming in here,
Spring,
I guess.
Spring coming in like a lion. PDGA Radio is there for it. Thanks again, Doug Bierkus, for joining us today. See ya.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.